Hello, and welcome to Healthy Bottom Line, a podcast from Chief Healthcare Executive. I'm Ron Southwick, lead editor of Chief Healthcare Executive. The fatal shooting at UPMC Memorial Hospital in Pennsylvania has horrified the nation. In this episode, we talk with Eric Sean Clay, a leading voice in hospital security, about the tragedy and efforts to make hospitals safer. Eric is the Vice President of Security at the Memorial Hermann Health System in Houston, Texas, and he's focused on safety every day. We're going to talk about creating a safety culture, the growing use of weapon detection systems, the importance of training and de-escalation, and a whole lot more. We'll get started in just a moment. This is Healthy Bottom Line. Thanks for joining us today. We're talking with Eric Sean Clay, the Vice President of Security at the Memorial Hermann Health System based in Houston, Texas. Eric's also the former president of the International Association for Healthcare Security and Safety. Eric, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Ron. Appreciate it.
Okay, let's dive in. Unfortunately, there's some really tragic news to talk about with the fatal shooting at UPMC Memorial Hospital in New York, Pennsylvania. It was shocking, to say the least. A police officer was fatally shot. Five others were wounded by gunfire. Three UPMC staffers, two local police officers. Another UPMC staffer was injured in a fall. You're in this field. Is this especially chilling when you hear of an incident like this at UPMC Memorial?
Oh, most definitely. We rarely hear of this sort of incident occurring where you have an armed intruder who attacks people inside of a hospital. I mean, it does happen occasionally, but this appears to be someone who was very motivated, very methodical, had come in with zip ties and had planned, it appears, to take hostages. So definitely very concerning when you have someone who has really thought out. It's not, a spur of the moment type thing. He has thought this out and has a plan on how he's going to carry it out.
Yeah, that's what the local prosecutors and authorities have said, that he had a hand had a gun, zip ties, one in with a bag of stuff, and definitely was holding people hostage, and actually had held one person at gunpoint when officers were forced to intervene. What conversations have been happening in the wake of this incident along the healthcare security community?
And I think it's just a tremendous amount of concern. Again, this is something that we don't see on a regular basis. I mean, we train for a lot of different situations, including active shooters and armed intruders. But hostage situations aren't really something that I think a lot of people are thinking about. So I think this has really caused people to really go back and look at some of their processes, their procedures, and how they would handle such an incident should it occur at their campus.
Unfortunately, like you said, this is especially unusual, but there have been some other fatal shootings at hospitals in the last few years. Has there been more conversations among hospital leaders and health systems in the wake of some of these fatal shootings about the need to take another look at their security procedures and their protocols?
I think so. I think we've seen a few security officers who've been shot and killed at facilities over the last year or two. So I think that you're seeing a lot more people concealed weapons detections becoming more prevalent. I think that's one of the things that we're going to start to really see be part of a standardized security management plan over the next 3 to 5 years. My experience with it, they've been very effective. So I think you'll see more people start to adopt that as we see more of these incidents occur. And hopefully we don't see more of these incidents occur. But again, we are starting to see where they were things that were unheard of. Now they are starting to become things that we see not regularly, but they definitely occur annually or periodically.
You've talked before about the need for greater protection for healthcare executives, hospital executives. We saw that last fall with the fatal shooting of the UnitedHealthcare CEO, Brian Thompson. It's been a few months now. Have you seen more discussions, more steps being taken to protect healthcare executives in the wake of that tragedy?
Yes, I mean, that's definitely been a conversation that a lot of people are having. At IHSS last month, we had a webinar on executive protection. It was completely full. We had people, on standby. So I think that to me suggests that there is a huge interest in this particular field, and that everyone that I've spoken to has said that their C-suite is really interested in developing programs like this. So I think where once we had executives who said, I, you know, this is not something that I really want to do. I don't like the optics of it. I don't like potentially the cost of it. Things like that. I think they're now becoming aware that there is a greater threat than there was in years past. And as times change, so must the processes and procedures we use to protect individuals. So I think that executive protection is something that is really on the minds of a lot of people. Getting a lot of questions about where can I go for training in order to train my team on how to become proficient in executive protection. So definitely a hot topic in healthcare right now.
We talked a little bit about weapon detection systems. Some hospitals are using them. Are you seeing in the last couple of years, in the wake of some of these incidents, more hospitals and health systems adopting technology to detect weapons?
Yes, I think you're seeing a lot of organizations that are using analytics and cameras that look for weapons. To me, that's a great technology to put on potentially the exterior of your vehicle. If you have people manipulating firearms in the parking lot, it gives you that opportunity, you know, perhaps 90 seconds to pick up on that and start sending security officers before the person gets to the facility. And then at your entrances, we're seeing a lot of more organizations that are putting those concealed weapons detection at the entrances. I'm also seeing X-ray machines that are being added. A couple of different vendors I've seen are putting X-ray machines alongside their concealed weapons detection. They're high speed X-ray machines. So as quickly as the person walks through the weapons detection system, their bag goes straight through the X-ray machine. I think it's green light, red light. If there's a red light, then there's a potential issue with the bag, and then the security officer can check that bag. But yeah, a lot of interest and a lot of people investing in those technologies right now.
I've seen them a lot, especially in emergency departments, since they're open around the clock. And those are some of the most, intense situations for patients, for their family members, for loved ones. What do hospitals and health systems need to think about if they're maybe putting in weapons detection, metal detectors in for the first time? What, because it's not just getting the equipment, it's also staffing for having these tools as well.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a whole process when you're looking at adding concealed weapons detection to your facility. I think, you know, what you really need to do is you look at you do your security vulnerability assessment. You look at what's going on in the community around me. Is there a need for it? I think, you know, sometimes people think, well, I need this particular technology, but I think it's best to look at what's going on in the community around you. Hospitals are microcosms of the communities they live in. Is there a lot of crime in your area? Look at the stats for your particular facility. A lot of workplace violence. Have we seen a lot of weapons, particularly that may have been introduced into the facility? And then determine that. And then another thing I think that is important is the on the staffing level. You're right. That is where the biggest expenditure goes with weapons detection system, and determining the appropriate staffing. Sometimes you're going to want two officers. You want to have an officer to operate the equipment, and then if there's a person that comes through and they indicate that there's potentially a weapon on that person, you're going to want that person, another officer, to be able to contact that person while the original officer is able to continue to have people going through, so that you don't have a bottleneck or someone who comes through and as a decoy to tie up that officer while other people try to get through and get something into the facility. So I think you need to look at that. And you know, one of the things that I think you can do is look at what are your ED admits. If you're going to go to the ED, as you kind of alluded to, that's where a lot of people are introduced into the system. A lot of your workplace violence occurs in the ED. I think you really look at what are your admits for your ED, and then determine what that looks like. You know, set a threshold. If we have X amount of admits, this is what we're going to do. We're going to have 4.2. If we have more than that, we're going to have the 8.4, and just look at your staffing, because again, that is where you're really going to spend a lot of your money.
You talked before about the optics in terms of executive protection. I know for some hospitals, health systems, they don't necessarily love the optics of having weapons detection systems in even the ED. They're worried about that makes it a little less welcoming. How do you deal with competing interests of wanting to make sure people feel safe, that you're not necessarily trying to discourage people from coming to the hospital, but at the same time, protecting the patients, staff, and visitors who are going to be there too.
I mean, I've heard organizations say that, but I think that, you know, the organizations that actually implement weapons detection have a completely different reaction from staff and from visitors. Anxiety levels go down tremendously whenever you implement weapons detection. Your staff realize that there's less opportunity for weapons to be brought into the system, which allows them to focus on providing quality care. I think your patients that come through, they realize there's less opportunity for problems. There's everybody sees the stories that come out about like the recent shooting. And so I think that allows them to really focus on what they're there for, and that's the providing the quality care that the patients are there to heal. And I think that everyone that I've talked to, and my personal experience has been that once you put the weapons detection in, people like it. And if you put it in at some hospitals and not other hospitals, I think you're going to see those other hospitals say we would like weapons detection as well. So again, I think this is going to be very standardized, and in the next several years, everyone is going to want to have weapons detection at their facilities.
Well, you're involved with security for a system with 17 hospitals, several cancer centers, any number of outpatient facilities. What are some of the things that you're doing at Memorial Hermann in terms of security that might be useful in terms of helping other health systems in terms of rethinking their security? Like, what are some things that you're doing that are working there that might be useful to other health systems?
Well, again, I think the concealed weapons detection, that is a big one. Other things that probably a lot of other health systems aren't doing is we are using Kevlar material in our EDs, putting that into the millwork of desks, putting that against the walls in our ED, so that on the off chance that someone should discharge a weapon in one of our facilities, it's not going to go through walls. It's not going to go through the desks. We're trying to limit the opportunity for someone to fire a weapon and actually hit somebody. Using impact-resistant films over glass to prevent things like that from happening, where someone shooting or someone throwing things, heavy objects, whatever that might be, and breaking glass, things like that. Introducing the first canine program for a healthcare system in the state of Texas. We think that is going to be a huge thing as far as, again, mitigating some of the workplace violence that we see, reducing anxiety. We added a lot of officers over the last year. We have the armed officer program that we are working towards arming all of our officers. I think that, when we've seen some of these shootings, after the shooting there at the healthcare system in Texas, or up in Dallas, Texas, where the patient's significant other started shooting healthcare workers, the only thing that stopped that person from continuing that rampage was a police officer that was there working at the facility stopped him. So we made the determination that we want to have that sort of capability ourselves to make sure that we can better protect our caregivers, that we can better protect our patients. So we have our own firing range. We have our own firearms training simulator, our own training center that we invest very heavily in to make sure our officers are trained very well. Duress alarms, wearable, duress alarms, I think is another big thing that allows people to feel better protected in the facility. And again, all of our security measures are really designed to alleviate concerns that our caregivers have. We really want them to feel protected. So we have invested very heavily tasers and body-worn cameras, things like that. Try to give our officers every tool that they need in order to really ensure the safety of everyone who comes to our facilities for care.
You mentioned some of the security officers that you have. A lot of healthcare systems have had trouble finding staff, like doctors, nurses. I've heard of some organizations have had trouble necessarily filling some of their security positions. I mean, is that an area where some systems are struggling to find the people they need?
Yes, I've seen a lot of studies that talk about caregivers are leaving in droves, and workplace violence is one of the reasons that's driving those numbers. So I think that really investing in the security program is one of those ways that you can differentiate yourself from other facilities. The heavy investment in that again allows them to feel better protected. And workplace violence again being a major concern for a lot of caregivers, if you can make them feel better protected, I think that you can retain your staff that you have. You can draw in staff from other particular hospitals who aren't making that investment. And for us, I think it's been a great investment. The ROI, I think, comes from retaining staff, and your your satisfaction scores go up. You have happy employees because they feel better protected than other facilities in the region. So I think that's it's a great use of your money. When you look at what it costs to recruit and train a nurse, it can be very costly. And if you make that investment in security, when you start looking at how many nurses that you potentially retain that were considering leaving, I think it pays for itself in a very short order.
In terms of actually recruiting the security staff themselves, is that an area where some hospitals struggle to find the right people? Is that an area of shortage as well?
Yeah, you hear that across the country that there's a lot of issue in finding appropriate numbers. But I think again that comes down to what are you doing? Are you paying a livable wage for your staff? And again, I think one of the things that we do well is that we invest very heavily in our security officers. Again, we have a very large state-of-the-art training center that we invest very heavily in the training of our officers. We want them to be the best security officers that they possibly can, so offer a lot of different training opportunities for them. So I think that's again another differentiator that you can have. Pay quite often can be fairly standardized in an area. There's a formula a lot of times I think that you look and you see online and it'll say this is what the prevailing rate is for a particular region. So pay can generally be very similar, but you can differentiate yourself again by the benefits that you offer, the training that you offer, the things that you're doing for your security officers, making them feel as part of a team, a part of a family, I think, which is things that we try to do. So we always have, officers that roles that we need to fill, but I think that we do a very good job in recruiting and retention.
Hearing a lot more discussion about the need to focus on de-escalation in hospitals and health systems and training staff to diffuse tense situations. How important is that de-escalation training in terms of creating a culture of safety?
Oh, I think, that's critical. Really, I think the reason it's so critical is that's, things escalate very quickly. And if you can really train your staff in recognizing early signs of aggression when people are starting to become upset and recognize that and then start to de-escalate before it becomes a very, significant problem, I think that's just a win for everybody at that point. Other things I think that you can do as far as de-escalation goes is, in the EMR, if you can put flagging in there now, I think that you can do that. You can kind of, if you have a person who's come in and they've been aggressive before, they've caused, incidents before, putting that information inside the patient's medical record, so that when they come and they check in, the people that are checking them can see that, and they can say this person has, done this in the past. Here's some of the things that triggered them in the past. Here's some of the things that we were able to do to help de-escalate that person, so that we don't cause that same escalation again. I think that's a great tool for us to use. And again, other things that I think have been very effective is programs like purposeful rounding, where sometimes you will see security officers who like to, kind of congregate and talk and hang out. Having programs where they're really up and moving and talking to people, being a visible deterrent to things that are going on, engaging with your charge nurse and your different nurses, and learning about particular patients that may be an issue, so that if they do get a call to the unit, they know that this is probably the patient that I'm going to be dealing with. Maybe you had the opportunity to go and talk to that patient before, try to develop a rapport with them, so that if you do have to go and interact with that patient, you're not seen as, the stick that's being waved at them. You're the guy who came in earlier, the gal who came in earlier, had a conversation with them, and then potentially able to help de-escalate that person rather than further escalate the issue.
Thinking about nurses, especially, and you've even mentioned them too, but they're so often on the front lines, and frankly, they're all too often the victims of these violent episodes we see in hospitals. What are some things hospitals and health systems can be doing to incorporate nurses' perspectives in terms of improving the safety of their organizations? Because it seems like they often say people aren't listening to us when we tell them about problems. So, how can hospitals do better in terms of making sure nurses are part of the solution and improving safety at the hospital?
Well, you're absolutely right. I think, nurses are typically the largest demographic of any healthcare facility you've got. So I think really, whatever they bring to the table, whatever they need are important considerations. And I think that, what we can do is We have to recognize that we have a professional responsibility to mitigate acts of workplace violence and to try to develop a culture where workplace violence isn't tolerated. And one of the issues I think we run up against is that nurses got into this this field because they want to help people, and sometimes they're very tolerant of workplace violence. And I think countering that and making them aware that this is not something that they should tolerate is something that we can do. I think you need to have a formal and comprehensive workplace violence prevention plan that really goes into the details of what that entails. Sometimes organizations just have a very quickly not well thought out plan that they've achieved or re received from somewhere else. I think that you need to have an easy reporting mechanism for employees to do. We have multiple ways that someone can report. We try to make it as easy for people to report workplace violence as we can. And to me, that's very important for a number of different reasons. We really want to understand what the problem is and how prevalent it is. We want to understand when it's occurring. We want to understand where it's occurring. We want to understand if we have people, sometimes an organization may have, a high incidence of workplace violence, but it's those incidents are created by a handful of people. And so if we can better manage that handful of people, we can greatly reduce incidents of workplace violence. So we really want to understand the size and scope of what's going on if we're going to try to really mitigate workplace violence. Another thing I think is really just communicating a commitment to reducing workplace violence, and that has to come from the top, from your CEO down, saying that this is something that we're passionate about, we believe in. I think staff really needs to know that they're supported, and that we're providing medical and psychological care for people who are involved in workplace violence, and that should probably include people who witness it, because I think there's a trauma that nurses who witness other nurses being assaulted, maybe they weren't assaulted, but it does affect them as well. So providing some sort of care for them can be important. And then again, I think just really training your staff on how to recognize those early signs of aggression and how to de-escalate people before things become even more serious. And then lastly, I would say probably just working with your security team. You have security leaders who quite often, they've perhaps they have the CHPA from IHSS or they have the CPP from ASIS, and they're subject matter experts in security. And so when they come to the organization, they say, here's something that we need that it be considered. As long as it's a well thought out and well reasoned suggestion, I think that when you have these subject matter experts, it could be around concealed weapons detection, again, duress alarms, access control, any number of things, but really trying to listen to them as they try to put some measures in to help reduce workplace violence, better protect our caregivers. That's very important.
You mentioned the importance of involvement from the top and developing and reinforcing workplace violence prevention plans. It strikes me that this is something that's got to be an ongoing conversation, that this is not something we developed a plan 5 years ago, so we're all good. I'm guessing this needs constant review, constant updating to address either different threats or even just simple things like, some of the streetlights being out on the street where people are parking. I mean, this has to be an ongoing effort, I'm guessing.
Certainly. I mean, it's as they always say, it's a living document. We're never going to just our workplace violence plan is not going to be something again that we sign off on and go, this is done. Typically, your organization is going to have at least a monthly meeting where they get together and they talk about here's the numbers on workplace violence, here's the trends that we're seeing, here's what we're going to try to do to stop it. It's typically multidisciplinary where you have representatives from a number of different departments. Of course, you're going to have nursing there because, again, they're the largest demographic. Typically, in the state of Texas, you have to have nursing, you have to have a practicing physician, you have to have a security professional, and those are mandatory to be part of your workplace violence committee. We've always had that prior to that anyway. And then just, different departments, legal, risk, quality. And they all report out on different aspects of workplace violence. And then we try to come up with what do we need to do to move the numbers on this. I think we've been very fortunate. Our team has been very effective in some of the measures that we've tried to come up with to help reduce some of these incidents of workplace violence. And, over the last year, we've seen about a 9% reduction. And if we can, hopefully do that year over year, that's a very significant number. So we keep working on it. And that's, again, that's the living document. We're making changes to it as time goes on in real time. You talked about the street lights being out, things like that. Again, those are things like security vulnerability plans that your team should be your security team should be doing on a regular, whatever annual basis that you've established, where they're looking at facilities, they're looking at problems. But there are also things that security officers should be noticing. If they see that there are lights out in your parking lot or something like that, that should be something that they recognize as a potential security vulnerability, and putting that in to get fixed as quickly as possible, so that we don't have criminals who prey upon people parking in the lot, whether it be catalytic converters, wheels, vehicles, or preying on visitors or employees who come to your facility.
You've been in this field for a while. What are the mistakes that systems sometimes make that just sort of drive you crazy a little bit as you talk with other professionals and you hear some steps that organizations could have taken but didn't? What are sort of the vulnerabilities or the mistakes that organizations make sometimes that can be really frustrating?
I mean, I think it's really difficult to say because every organization is going to be different. The risk is going to be different. The risk appetite is going to be different. But I mean, there are some things that you could probably point to, and I think that one of those is we look at and I say we, I mean the industry sometimes looks at security strictly as a cost center. And if there's a budget deficit, some of the things that they will initially do is go, let's just start cutting security FTEs. That's something that we don't necessarily need. We don't see a return on that. So it doesn't generate any revenue. Or they will assign, non-security functions to security officers, where they'll have them changing lights and pulling them, doing different things that pull them away from their primary function, which is, being a visible deterrent, responding to security issues, and doing things that really provide value in the security realm. So those are things that I don't like hearing about, because again, I really want, being passionate about security, you want security to be the best it can possibly be. And when we do things like that, I see, vulnerabilities and opportunities for people to do things that they probably shouldn't. I think that causes damage to the security brand at that point if they're not seen as security professionals. And if once, I think nursing or caregivers lose faith in your security department, that can be a problem. So those were probably two of the big ones for me, is really around those two areas.
Wanted to also ask you about you've offered a lot of insights that I think are applicable to health systems for different sizes, but especially for smaller hospitals or smaller systems, even like some rural hospitals that just may not have the resources they'd like to really invest in some of the steps they'd like to do, but they just don't have the resources. What are some things there's smaller systems, rural systems, what can they do to improve their security, even if they don't have the money to spend that they'd like?
I would say some of the things I think you could do is probably look for a bring in an outside consultant who can probably help with some suggestions on things that you could do. I think it's important too, when you're looking at consultants, there's some people out there who say that they're security experts who really don't have any security experience or healthcare security experience. Find a professional who's got the certifications, who's got the time, who's got references, who can tell you about things that they've done. And when you find that person and you bring them in, give them access to everything and let them tell you some of the things that they think that you could do. And then you can use that particular document as kind of a guide on what we want to do. For critical access hospitals, rural hospitals, things like that, there's quite often grants you can get from the state and you get from the federal government that can help fund some of these initiatives that you might want. Hospitals are part of critical infrastructure, so the Department of Homeland Security has a lot of different grants that they're willing to put forth. And if you're a critical access hospital, which means that you're providing care and typically in an area where there's no other facilities and you're necessary, I think you have a really good opportunity to get some money there. Some hospitals have foundations that work in the community to try to generate some funds for different things for the hospital. So, if you have a foundation and they're reaching out to different people within the community, corporate donors, things like that, there's opportunities to use that money to build upon and to get things that you need for your hospital. Again, I think security sometimes can be often overlooked, but in this day and age, I think security is becoming more and more important. as we see, incidents of workplace violence rising, more violent incidents than we've seen in years past. OSHA says about 73% of all reported workplace violence occurs in the healthcare setting. And I could throw a bunch of stats at you that talk about those numbers. And we know that as disturbing as those numbers are, that there's a huge amount of underreporting, that nurses don't report all the workplace violence that occurs. So we know that number is significantly higher. So again, my belief is that if you can improve your security posture, reduce those incidents of workplace violence, you can retain some of your staff that might be thinking about leaving the industry and going to do something else that pays equally as well, but they don't have the chance of being assaulted that they have in healthcare.
I think you've mentioned it a couple of times. I think it's really important, worth reinforcing the idea of this as being a tool in recruiting and retention of key staff members too. If you're showing them that you're investing in security or even just incorporating workers more in workplace prevention plans, you have a better chance to keep some folks from leaving. And also you send an important message too, that you really do care about the staff. You're listening to them and their
That's the key.
concerns.
I mean, that your staff, your caregivers and your staff, that's your most important asset that you have in a healthcare system. And protecting them, to me, as a security professional, that's job one, making sure that they're there and they are able to provide the care that people need. Nothing more important, I think, in our job.
Well, I know we're pretty much at the end of our window. So, Eric, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. We really appreciate the time and think you shared some important insights that are going to be helpful to some health systems. So, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Healthy Bottom Line, a podcast from Chief Healthcare Executive. You can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. For the latest healthcare news, compelling features, and deeper dives, visit chiefhealthcareexecutive.com. You can also follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, and X. I'm Ron Southwick, lead editor of Chief Healthcare Executive. Take care.